All right, so we're back with yet another super thrilling episode of V8 Radio. I'm Kevin Ostie, joined, of course, by Mr. Mike Cuball Clark.
I am so thrilled to be here.
I can tell. Well, last time you were riveted, so...
I riveted? Yeah, I just got unriveted, now I'm thrilled.
Yes, well, I'd be thrilled to be unriveted myself.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
It's part of the challenge, you know, is coming up with a different adjective to describe how exciting this operation really is each time.
It's not difficult because it's just, it's everything, right?
It is what it is, as they say. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what's the latest on your end, man?
Oh, well, I did have a bit of an update. I didn't mention it on our last broadcast, but I spoke to my machinist a couple weeks ago. I called him up, and he made some progress. He realized that the pistons that he did get delivered were not, in fact, the correct ones, so he has to reorder them. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest update. And I mentioned to him before. I never mentioned to him what my timeline was,
of
just
course
thinking
not.
That
yeah,
he
yeah.
would just get it done. Yeah. But I didn't say, "Hey, take your time," either, because from what I understand, that's not what you tell a machinist.
No, you don't tell a machinist or a restoration shop that there is no deadline.
Right. So, but I did tell him, I said, you know, the Hot Rod Power Tour is coming up. I would really love to be able to drive my car to a few stops. And that's what I'm aiming for. He says, okay, I gotcha. We'll work on that.
So, all right. So the GTO engine is creeping forward now. It's
lurching ever so slightly.
We have,
like, at a glacial pace.
We have verified we have the wrong stuff.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And we have verified that.
So has the order been placed, you know,
for
the...
It has. Well, that day when I talked to him, after we got off the phone, he placed it. So.
All right.
But again, it's a special order piston, so who knows how long it's going to take to come. Because there's a specific dish that has to be machined into the head.
Right.
So, you got a trivia question to throw out there?
Oh, right. Almost forgot. Yeah. I was so busy trying to come up with an adjective for how exciting the show is that I almost forgot the trivia question. So you want me to go first, is what you're saying?
Yeah, you go first this time.
All right. Well, this one falls in the 80s, which was a hint, not much of one. And I don't know if this is going to be difficult for you or not, but it's a little bit out of the wheelhouse. It's a Ford question.
Oh, gosh. All right.
And a pretty simple one. In what year did the Mustang 302 receive a roller cam?
That would be, you know what? I actually read about this in a popular hot rodding issue in the 80s.
Yes. If you could only remember what year that was.
Yeah. I'm going to say 1980. 83.
You
got a roller cam.
Yeah, the Mustang kind of...
Hang on, when did the Fox body came out in 79, right?
Right. Are you backtracking now again already?
Yeah. I'm going with 83. Okay. 83 is my answer.
All right.
Final answer.
Well, yeah, it was kind of interesting the way that Fox body Mustang evolved, and it seemed like Ford was playing catch-up behind the Camaro and mm-hmm. Firebird. Trans Am and the IROC and the Z28 and everything. So it seemed like every year they were making what was kind of a big improvement to that car. Mm-hmm. And rather than do everything all at once, in one particular year they did the roller cam upgrade, which was huge. Mm-hmm. I think that was good for about 30 horsepower in that particular car.
Yeah, that's huge.
And at a different time period, they went from carburetor to fuel injection, and that added another... I don't know, 15 or 20. But even so, at the height of that car's popularity, or I guess in the decade of the 80s, it was only a 225 horsepower car.
Yeah.
But it's a great example of something that had power when it needed it. It made enough torque anywhere you wanted it to mm-hmm. where it actually performed well and felt great to drive. I mean, I had an 86 5.0 GT car with a 5-speed.
Nice.
Yeah, it was a convertible I bought when I was in California. One of the people I worked with.
Do you have
with.
A mullet with that and everything?
No, I didn't, as a matter of fact. My mullet days were long behind me at that point. But I thought the mullets were for the 77 Firebird guys.
I think that whole pony car era, the mullet, I think, fit real nicely.
Yeah. You know, I could have done the bald mullet thing, you know, shave the top and grow out a neck beard in the back. But that car was a steal, man. I got it for $1,100, and it was a rust-free California convertible with working air conditioning and the 5.0 and a 5-speed. Yeah, it was killer.
Wow.
And Kelly didn't like it just because I kind of made it a pile. And
did you really?
I drove the heck out of the thing, and it was a driving restoration, you know. So it was gray with a gray interior, and the top was shot because out there you don't even need one in Southern California. And I was doing this. I actually did a paint story on that car for Hot Rod. There's a body and paint, you know, cheap amateur paint job story on that thing. We changed it to red, and it was pretty cool because I could go to the junkyards on half price day, and I remember the car had a factory luggage rack on the deck lid, which I hated on that car.
Oh yeah, I remember those.
Yeah, it was silly. And the convertible shared the deck lid with the notchback coupe Mustang, so I needed a door because mine was dented. I needed a fender because I bumped into a concrete pole. and I wanted to pick up a deck lid. And I went to this pick your part out there and ended up coming home with all three of those parts. I think on half price day, I think I paid $9 for the deck lid.
Wow. Holy cow.
Oh, yeah. And I think the door was regular price like $24 and I got it for $12, you know. So it was killer. I got a whole bunch of cheap body work, and then did a respray on the car, painted it red, and blacked out the trim like it was supposed to be new again instead of faded gray, and performance wise, all we really did do it was change it from a speed density to a mass air meter fuel injection system, which a speed density unit is a calculation. It calculates. It says, well, I think at this RPM, I should be pulling in this much air, which means I should be spraying this much fuel.
This much fuel. Okay.
And that works perfectly when the car's new because the rings are sealing and the valves are sealing and nothing's worn out. But over time, the air requirements change. Mm-hmm. And a mass air system actually measures the air coming in.
Sure.
And then dictates how much fuel. And this car had like 150,000 on it when I did this conversion. And it was like a brand new car. It
really
radically changed the behavior. Much more power.
Wow.
Oh, it was great. Yeah, yeah.
Huh. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so it was a fun little car. And like I said, I bought it for about $1,100. And I spent some money on the paint job. And, you know, not like real money, you know, just materials money for me. And I didn't get super top line materials. I didn't need it. It was just a driver. So I think I probably had a couple thousand in it. I had a new top put on it, white top, so it was red, white. And the fun one was the carpet. I ripped the seats out one day and hung the carpet on a chain link fence outside our shop and just hosed it and sprayed it with Simple Green. I thought the carpet was black, and the stuff that ran out of this thing while hanging on the fence on the ground, it had to have been toxic. It was just this nasty black tar. Again, being a
primordial ooze coming out of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, I think it got up and walked away at the end when it was done. it was brutal. And the carpet was light gray, I learned after that.
Whoa.
So that was a cheap tip. If you want to do it, you want to clean the car, take the carpet out, hang it on a fence, and I have a foam gun that attaches to the hose, and you fill the hopper there with Simple Green, and then just spray it and let it soak. So cheap and easy interior job. And I ended up selling the car to some guy in Texas for like close to $4,000 when it was done.
Get out of town.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a good car.
Wow, that's a nice investment.
Yeah, right. So anyway, that's my trivia question. What year for the roller cam? You say 83. I will note that.
All right.
And
I think it was 85, but I'm sticking with 83.
Oh, sure, yeah. I think it was 80.
Oh, I'm just saying. I'm going to stick with my answer.
All right. Man of integrity.
I'm a man of my word.
There you go.
I'm not backtracking, but I think I'm wrong. But I think it's really going to be 85.
19.
I digress.
Three. All right. Well, what's your question that I can get wrong this week?
All right. All right. I did have kind of a softball Rochester Quadrajet question, but I decided to let go of that one for something a little bit better. In 1967, if a person were to walk into the showroom and buy a 1967 Camaro, how many engine choices did they have to choose from?
That's a good question. So we had the 256 cylinder. We had a 302. We had a 327. Are we talking different power levels of each one, too, or just
no,
displacement?
No, just displacement.
302, 327, 250 six-cylinder, and a big block. I'm not sure. I think it was three.
Is that your final answer?
I'm going to get barbecued for this, but I don't think the 396 was available in a 67 right out of the box. Yeah, why not? I'll just say three. That's fine.
Three.
Yeah.
All right. I will notate that in my notes. Three.
That,
Mr. Osteen.
Yeah, that's cruel because that's you know, something that I'm supposed to know right off the top of my head.
That just hurt some business, buddy.
Yeah. Nice.
All right. So what else is going on in the shop today?
I will caveat that.
Or this week, rather.
I will caveat to say that it would be the big block 396 also if it was available in 67, which I just, you don't see. So, and I'm resisting. I'm not looking this up. I'm just going to ride this one out.
Yeah, taking a little time. I see your fingers tapping the keyboard.
Yeah, it's not looking that up, though. I'll take my lumps on that one. Don't get me wrong. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you my Rochester question, because this is too easy. I'll never use this. Because of the incredible demand of the Rochester Quadrajet in GM cars, they had to outsource manufacturing to another company. What was that company? You gotta be kidding me.
Well, I think Carter was building them for a while.
Yeah, it was Carter.
And I also know that those were branded as Motorcraft.
Yeah. I think they were branded, they had a Rochester by Carter on the body.
Yeah.
That's how you could tell if it was a Rochester, a Carter-built Quadrajet.
Yeah, well, and again,
Quadrajet by Carter, yeah, that's what it would say.
They also ended up in some Ford cars as well. And I know some of the Mustangs, and I think some of the truck applications might have had a Rochester Quadjet, but it had an Autolite part number on it, or a Motorcraft part number on it.
Yeah. You're right. That's right. Oh, the cobwebs are getting cleared out of here now.
Now,
good.
Could you imagine if you had a Motorcraft Quadrajet Rochester by Carter?
Yeah. That's quite a mongrel there, isn't it?
Yeah, right. That's probably why they went to fuel injection. They just couldn't fit all that on the...
Yeah, exactly. They ran out of room on the body.
On the carb body. Well, this...
It's kind of funny how different manufacturers would use each other's parts. I know GM had the Dearborn 3-speed in some of their cars as well. I know my 66 Le Mans had a Dearborn 3-speed on the floor when I had it.
Yeah. Well,
kind of interesting stuff.
Yeah, there is a lot of cross-pollination. The Saginaw power steering pumps ended up in a lot of multi-make stuff. And in the 80s and 90s, the Rolls-Royce, it's a trivia question, but I'll give it up. Rolls-Royces used turbo 400s.
Is that right?
Yeah, the big Rolls-Royce.
I did not know that. Oh, you would have melted my mind with that one.
Darn it.
Dang it.
Yeah, well...
Oh, that was a good. I never knew that at all. I mean, it's a great transmission. Heavy car, big power. It's perfect.
They also, I'll give up one more, but we're not ever going to go into Rolls Royce territory on this show. The AC systems were frigid air, so they had A6 GM frigid air compressors on them. And
no kidding.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm. So you know they shifted and they cooled, you know, the occupants well. I can't say much about the rest of the car, but
yeah, that's for sure. It's a great AC system. I know my GTO is a factory air car. When it was running, that air was kicking hard.
Oh yeah,
I loved it.
Well, so you asked what was going on in the shop. The shop is very busy, which is great. Lots of cool projects going on. We have one that's a Pontiac, kind of a boomerang project that we started and had to stop on and got back into just because our customer had some unforeseen delays, which really, really sucked. He got sick, which was just a bummer. Yeah. But he's doing far better now. He's doing great now.
Good.
And it's a 78 Trans Am SE Bandit car.
All right.
That he brought in last year to do an EFI swap, an overdrive transmission, and a gear because he's going to run this on the Snowman's Run. And nice. He had done the Snowman's Run many times before and always came home on a trailer.
Oh, no.
With different cars. Yeah. So now with this car, he really wanted to run this thing, and he wasn't going for the over-the-top, supercharged, you know, high-power car. He wanted something a little more reliable. So that car, it's a Pontiac 400. Not an original SE car. It was a Trans Am, I believe, but it's got the SE, you know, stripe package and all the rest of it on it. And that's the one that we did the fuel injection swap on. We did a fast, easy EFI system on it. We did a 204R overdrive, and the oil pan gasket was leaking, and he said, can you take a look at that? So we pulled the oil pan and found a whole bunch of shavings in the bottom of the pan.
Oh, yeah. I remember you talking about that car before.
Yeah. Which was a real letdown. But today, so we did a kind of a quick engine freshen up and had that one redone. Guy's got it all back together now, and it runs and drives great. And getting back to AC, it's a factory air car that we're kind of tuning up the AC on, doing a conversion on it and making it nice and comfy. And our mission for this one is he wants taken on that Snowman's Run, which is at the end of June this year down in Georgia. And that particular run, I don't know if you know.
I've heard of it, but I'm assuming it's going from like Texarkana to Georgia or something.
Yeah, originally there was the Bandit Run, which kind of did that run. And then the Bandit Run kind of grew and went in a direction, and the Snowman's Run started. And the guy that is behind the Snowman's Run actually has the semi. He's got the rig, you know, with the mural on the side and everything. And this year, I think the two of them are converging together. The Snowman's Run, I believe, it's not really a big run this year. It's more of an event that is doing a bunch of different things in the Atlanta area over the course of a week or something. And they are, this is the 40th anniversary of Smokey and the Bandit, so they're going to be showing that somewhere down there, and everybody's going to have a good time.
Wow. But 40th anniversary. Jeez, I feel old now.
Yeah, right. I remember when it came out. I know, me too.
Yeah, I do too.
But so he needs to drive that car from where we are, kind of in the St. Louis area, down to Atlanta and back, and participate in all these events reliably without any problems. So I'm glad that we know this, you know, and that we can make sure that this car is tuned up and ready to rock. So we're probably going to put, I told him, I said, I want no less than 500 miles on this car when it leaves our shop, you know, so that we can make sure everything is happy and functioning and good oil pressure and all the rest. So,
yeah.
So it was cool to see that one come back in because that means it's getting ready.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Now on the flip side, in my own personal shop at home here in the garage, I'm in a battle, and not really an awful one, but I've got two broken cars now, so I feel your pain.
No.
The Riv, my 70 Buick, is demonstrating signs of transmission failure.
No.
As we just talked up how great a Turbo 400 is.
I didn't say they were indestructible. No, but they're really good.
Nothing against this personal or against that transmission, but the it shifts from 1 to 2 okay, 2 to 3 was getting later and later and slipperier and slipperier, and first thought was that the vacuum modulator was going, because it's an original car, it's, 30,400 miles on it now, so I thought it can't be a bad transmission already. I mean, it's only been 47 years.
A mere pittance.
Right.
In the grand scheme of things.
So it was time for a transmission fluid change, which could have been the original juice in that one.
Ooh, yeah. That probably was.
And my approach on that was when I bought the car a year and a half ago, it shifted fine, so I didn't screw with it, So maybe it was my...
Yeah, if it ain't broke.
My mistake to not just go ahead and change that right away. Mm-hmm. So a vacuum modulator is this thing that controls a valve inside the transmission, and when you make engine vacuum is something that a lot of people get inverted. When the throttle blades are closed on the engine, the pistons, as they pull down, are starving for air. They're sucking air in. And when you step on the gas, the throttle opens and allows that engine to breathe, so the vacuum level actually goes down. So your engine vacuum is highest when the throttle is closed. Mm-hmm. So they've created all these little mechanisms to capitalize on that source of vacuum. And the first thing you check is to make sure you don't have any vacuum leaks. And I found a bunch of those, which was good. So I replaced all the hoses and found my carburetor was sucking air all through the sides and everything. And
everywhere except where it's supposed to.
Yeah, totally. So, I'm like, oh, well, that'll be an easy fix. And I go drive it and it's still slipping. So then I put a new modulator in it. And after I changed the fluid that didn't do it. So then the other thing that's kind of an easy fix on those is the governor. And the governor is a deal that's got a centrifugal weight mechanism. And as you accelerate, it controls the shifting action. It has the final say on when this thing shifts. And I took the governor out and cleaned it all out, and it was fine. And I put it back in, and we're still there. So I'm going down that road, The last couple steps are, when I changed the vacuum modulator, I didn't pull the actual vacuum valve out of the transmission, so it still might be stuck in there to where the modulator can't fix it, can't control it. So fingers are crossed on that one, because that's easy.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
Otherwise, it's change the transmission time, rebuild this one, and if I'm going to pull it and rebuild it, I might as well put an overdrive in the car.
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not? Might as well.
Which means we go down the road of this thing being apart for 9 years.
Yeah.
Because might as well syndrome kicks in. And
you're in good company, my friend.
Yeah.
Things been apart for 2 years already.
Yeah, so I'm trying to avoid that at all costs. And I have an overdrive in storage that was the transmission that actually... it came out of an 81 Olds 98 Regency that was the donor for the S71 Olds turbo car we did.
Right.
That Regency was a diesel Oldsmobile, and it had a great block, and we used that block to build that S71 Cutlass.
Okay.
But the transmission is a 204R, which is a mechanically shifted, meaning non-electronic, overdrive. Mm-hmm. That has a Buick Olds Pontiac and Chevrolet bolt pattern on the back.
Oh, winner, winner, chicken dinner.
Yeah, and it's about the same length as a Turbo 400.
Yeah. That 200 is a great swap for those older cars.
Yeah. So
just got to make sure it's strong enough.
And the Grand National version was the one to have, and companies make beef up parts. And again, this isn't a race car, and it was strong enough to haul around probably a 5,000-pound Olds 98, right?
Yeah.
So that's my thinking there. And if I'm going to pay to rebuild one, because I'm not an automatic transmission guy, I might as well pay to do that one other than the regular 400. So that's the one broken car. The other one is the Galaxy developed a bit of an axle seal leak, And I had just put a bearing on this thing, and I say just. It was only 2 years ago, but I just put this bearing on.
Well, I mean, it should still be running. It should still be sealing after 2 years, I think.
Right. And the chronology of miles isn't very many. You know, it's probably got 5,000 miles on this bearing, if that, 2,000 maybe. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, yeah, no problem. I'll just pull this thing out and take a look at it. And, well, it turns out that the bearing, if you can envision, it's a ball bearing, wheel bearing, not a taper roller bearing. And,
sure.
And on both sides of the bearing is a pressed-in little plastic kind of seal. It's not really a typical seal, but it's a plastic cover that kept the grease inside mm-hmm. the bearing. Well, that decided to leave the bearing housing and drip the grease out. And that, you know, okay, no big deal. So I'm thinking I probably should press on a new bearing, but it is a brand new bearing, basically, and that means take the car down to the shop or pull the axle and go to the shop and do all that stuff. So I kind of whipped up a little bit of a quick fix of, I was able to snap that plastic thing back in, and I used some of the yellow 3M, as we call it, Gorilla Snot, you know, the 3M gasket glue that you can never get off,
right.
You know?
So no.
I put some of that stuff on there and put it all back together. Well, in my haste, I this car has a disc brake conversion on the back that we did, you know, almost 20 years ago. And part of that disc brake conversion involves some wheel spacers. To stand the wheel off the rotor a hair.
Okay.
And I, like a bonehead, and I will admit my mistake, instead of doing rotor wheel space wheel, I put wheel spacer rotor wheel.
Oh.
And it's a, which ends up putting the caliper in kind of a funk on the rotor, but it goes together smoothly because it's a floating caliper. Huh. So the caliper,
oh, okay.
and the caliper was opened, the pads were spaced apart far enough that, you know, it didn't feel like a big bind or anything.
Oh, okay, I'm with you.
Yes.
I'm with you now.
So I was able to bolt the caliper back on the rotor okay and put everything together and drove it around the block, and it's squealing like nuts, you know, it sounds like brakes are failing. So put it back, put it up on the jack stands, walk away from it, you know, and come back. This is a 3-week project at this point.
Oh boy.
The second weekend I go back and tear it all apart. Well, it should have been a 5-minute fix. Should have been take the wheel off, rearrange caliper, rotor, spacer, put the wheel back on. But no, a wheel stud decides to spin in the axle flange.
Oh man.
So now I'm spinning this. You know, I got an impact wrench that I was just cracking the nuts loose with, and it's just like zzz, and I'm like, that is not a good sound.
No.
Which means,
oh,
you know,
brother.
So how do you, I know how to do this and cause great harm to everything.
Oh.
You know, I could get a grinder in there and mess up my freshly restored wheels, and you know, but I didn't want to do that. So
the
short version of the end was, luckily being a disc brake car, I was able to get hardware and wrenches on the backside to where I could take apart the brakes and fish the axle out, still bolted to the wheel.
Wow.
And put the wheel, tire, and axle assembly on my workbench and get a Dremel tool down inside the backside of the rotor and carve out the wheel stud and separate it. And luckily, the stud itself, it's got knurls on it, and it did its job, and those gave way, and it didn't, like, open up the axle hole. So,
oh, okay, good.
I had another wheel stud, coincidentally, because that's a whole other story, but I was able to press another one back in, and that seems to have solved that problem, and now it's all back together. I still got to do a test drive, but the moral of this particular story is, A, I need to learn to take my own advice, because for a long time I've been putting together kind of a process on how to enjoy this stuff more, rather than just be forced into, you know, this darn car, and, you know, I got to fix this thing now, and it sucks, you know.
You're right.
Because it's kind of silly when we look at these things as our hobby or our passion that we like to do, and then just hate doing some of this stuff so much.
And people. Yeah, it sure was a lot more enjoyable when I was about, you know, 30 years younger.
Well, there's that. There is a physical aspect.
Yeah, sometimes having to crawl under the dash sometimes with his front seat still in there, you kind of think about how badly you really need to do that. Like, oh, man, I really don't want to contort myself under there again. And it's so uncomfortable at times. And
right, exactly. You know, and the other thing, too, is that we are talking about working on an enthusiast car and not a repair. Right. You know, because if it's something that failed and you got to fix this thing to get to work in the morning, that's a whole different deal.
Right.
But I've developed some pointers, I think, that can kind of make this a little more of a smoother job. And I know that when we do these things, there are distractions and there's all kinds of stuff that really makes for the take away the enjoyment of being able to work on something. And I kind of put it in a little bit of a timeline and just kind of use a week as a model, you know. So say, for example, the car breaks, you know, over the weekend or something. What I've learned is that it's always best to maybe plan out the approach like on the following weekend, because most of us only have time nights and some weekends to work on this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I think the first thing to do is to get the clearance to have the time. Right?
Yeah, that helps.
Because how many times do you go out, you know, oh, Saturday morning, I'm going to get up and go out in the garage, I'm going to work on the car, and then all of a sudden somebody comes in and says, yeah, we have to be at Aunt Edna's 900th birthday party in 15 minutes.
Oh, didn't I tell you?
Right? You know, or Timmy's got to go to a baseball game, and those things are very important, and it's like, oh, no, you know, so... Mm-hmm. If you can establish, hey, all right, next Saturday, can I have, 3 hours or whatever to make sure? And the next thing is, I like work time to be work time and not work time to be research time. So during the week, maybe there's an opportunity at lunch to jump online and find the research on what it is that you're trying to fix.
Sure.
But make sure you bookmark all those pages so that you don't spend another hour trying to find where you were.
Well, yeah, there's that.
Well, it's like, yeah, I knew on one of these forums this guy just did that, but I don't remember of the 800 forums I go to which one it was in.
Oh, God, I know it. I know it.
And another thing that I think is helpful is to talk to other people early in the week and tell them that you're going to be doing this. So if you've got a buddy down the street or your wife or your son or daughter, or somebody that's going to help you out, because that way they can tell you that they have to go to Aunt Edna's 900th birthday and they're not going to be around to help you hold something or if it's your only car, you know, to take you to the store, you know, or whatever you might need. So if you know you got your backup helpers, at least in contact, that can be a big thing. And when it comes to the process, there's a word that a cameraman that we use, actually one of the guys that helps us shoot Muscle Car of the Week, his name is Evan. And Evan used a term that I use all the time. It's called mentalizing.
I like it.
Yes. And to me, I find it helpful to mentalize the process, you know. So it's like, okay, well, first thing Saturday morning, I'm going to go out in the garage. What am I going to do? I'm going to work on the car. Well, the car is in the ground. I got to put it up on jack stands. Do I have my jack stands? Right?
Are they in the shop or did someone borrow them?
Correct. Yeah, yeah. So if this is Monday and you're doing this job on Saturday, you got time to chase down all your junk maybe put oil in the floor jack and, you know, get all that stuff ready to rock.
That's good advice.
Yeah. Again, it's hard for me to take my own advice, but it's just something that I've learned. And then when it comes to the parts store, we all know that going to the parts store turns into a half-day affair, even if it's two blocks away, because you go there, then parts store A doesn't have what they said they had in stock. And it's got it can be here at 11 from our East Kalamazoo store, you know, or whatever. So then you go to parts store B and they've got something close and it isn't exactly right, but you buy it anyway. And then you say, this isn't exactly what, let me go to parts store C just because I really want the Moog brand instead of the off brand. Right? Oh, and then then I'm hungry. It's lunchtime, so let's go to lunch. Well, if we're going to go to lunch, let's call Dave and have Dave meet us out for a cheeseburger, and then Dave's got to go somewhere. And next thing you know, your day's done. right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that, getting back to Part Store A, B, and C, I mean, because these enthusiast cars we're working on are, you know, maybe 40-plus years old, you know, Part Store A, B, and C may not even have these parts that we're looking for. They could be something that you can only get through mail order, through an aftermarket enthusiast site like a Performance Years or an Ames or a OPGI or any of those guys, and you're going to have to mail order it, and maybe it's going to take 3 or 4 days to get there. So you got to get your ducks in a row, like you said, get everything together on Monday before you're going to work on this stuff on the weekend, and do your research, and hey, I got to order this, you know, Johnson rod. I can only get through Ames, and you know, it's going to take 3 days to get here. I better get on it.
Absolutely. You know what I mean? Yeah. And in the case of this Galaxy, I was lucky that I didn't have to destroy anything, because these caliper brackets, I think it's a stainless steel brake kit. And if I needed to, if I, you know, bent one or something, who knows how long that would have taken to order and get one in. Right.
Yeah, like you said, it was 20 years ago you did that. Who knows if they even manufacture that?
And the truth is, yeah, after looking it up, I can't even get this exact kit. So that would have been,
Yeah, that would have been devastating.
Let's now redo the whole brake system under pressure, not the way that I really might want to.
Yeah.
There's all that stuff. And then what we've also learned is that the parts store, I've learned to, and the parts stores, the local guys don't like me that much for doing this, but it is very helpful. Have them get or buy as well the ancillary parts that are around whatever it is that you're doing. So if you're doing an alternator, maybe get another plastic pigtail connector that connects to the alternator, because you might take yours out, and being 45 years old, it might break the tab or it might be cracked, right? And you can get
just turned into dust.
Exactly. So, you know, extra seals or bearings or fittings or hoses or wiring pigtails, you know, you might not use it, but it's going to reduce your chances of having to go back to the parts store again and then order something and wait another week. So take a survey of whatever it is you're working on and say, hey, I think there's a gasket there or a seal. And even if you might not be getting that far into it, you know, all of them will take it back. You know, you can return all the stuff that you don't use or put on a shelf or eBay or whatever. And then it's also time to take an inventory of what you got in the shop. Hand cleaner, you got enough hand cleaner and shop towels. Brake cleaner around here is like water. It's like an essential
life. I believe
it.
Sure. Like, it stuff really works. It takes a lot of gunk off.
Use it on everything. So yep. I tend to always pick up at least 3 or 4 cans if I got a project or not, you know, just to have it. Because how it is. You're halfway through it and you go, oh, man. Now I
got. Yeah. Your hands are black. If you don't have any gloves or whatever, your hands are all greasy and you're just look like you just came out of a burning building, for crying out loud. And then you got to get into your car, and then you got to go to the parts store looking like
right,
this.
Yeah, right. Make sure you got some kind of spill cleanup materials. You know, that's always an afterthought. And then you're playing hockey to get the cat turds out of the box to find some clean litter to go dump.
Sorry, kitty, yeah. I just need to borrow this.
Yeah, you have to hold it, man, or go outside or something.
Oh, that's perfect.
Well, you know what's worse is when you find the cat doing his business under your car.
Spreading that crap everywhere.
Here you go. And then, you know, other fluids and stuff, you know, in this case, I happen to have a bottle of 75W90 gear oil to be able to top off my rear axle because in my process of trying to get that axle out with the wheel on it, I actually had to articulate the rear end and point the axle tube downward just so the tire would clear the wheel well to get it out, which meant I dumped half the fluid out of the rear end, which was unanticipated.
Daggone it.
Yeah, right. And then there's, of course, we touched a little bit on the jack stands, the tools. Is there a tool that, you know, check your own inventory, like you said before, make sure that, you know, everything that's been loaned out is returned. But do you have to buy something? Can you rent something from the parts store you know, a puller or some kind of a compressor or something, you know, make sure you got all that. Mm-hmm. Make sure you have enough light as we age gracefully.
Let there be light.
Yeah. I've learned that it's kind of a neat thing. These LED regular home light bulbs that mm-hmm. looked like just a regular incandescent bulb you put in a lamp.
Right.
These things uh-huh. are awesome. Now you can get LED ones. They don't make any heat.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. They make a ton more light. You can drop them and they uh-huh. don't go out and they don't break. They're not glass.
Oh, that's nice.
They're only...
I've been using compact fluorescents in my drop lights. And they're okay. But if you do drop them, they sometimes will break and you got, you know, glass... fluorescent bulb glass everywhere, and then you're inhaling the mercury that comes out.
Yeah, you're supposed to call a hazmat team if you break one of those. Yeah. If you read the box.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So
I know what I'm supposed to do, Kevin. You know?
Yeah. Well, this whole episode is what I'm supposed to do also.
Yeah. Yeah. So shut up.
Well, that's, you know, part of the reason I got away from those. Once I discovered the LEDs, I'm putting those things everywhere. So
yeah,
those are cool.
That's a great idea. I think I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah. And then little stuff, clamps and mechanics wire. Make sure you have enough of that junk, you know, because if you're doing this by yourself, you can't say, hey, hold this for a minute. You know, mm-hmm. hold this caliper while I do this, wire it up.
Yeah. Honey, can you come here? I need your help.
Yeah, right, exactly.
No.
And Edna's birthday cake, you know, she's making it.
Right,
so.
Right, right.
Another trick that I've learned is to wear a pocketed shirt and keep the cell phone in the pocket.
Ah.
And this way,
never thought of
yeah,
that.
If somebody calls, it's right there. Or, you know, God forbid something happens to you, you don't have to crawl out from somewhere to try and reach a phone if you get hurt.
That's a good point, too.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I'm kind of a geek about this stuff, and I like to take pictures, you know, along the way. And that's just another thing, not just because I like to take pictures and put them on websites and stuff, but if it's together, take a picture of it now. Because as we age gracefully, our memories get sharper, right?
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah, like sharp as a bowling ball. Yeah. Oh, yeah. How did that bracket go on there?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
my gosh.
So take a lot of pictures of the work so that you can put it all back together smoothly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, in the garage, you make sure the radio is there and the conveniences to make it more enjoyable. You know, you got to have some kind of drinks, you know, whatever that mm-hmm. might be. I like to keep a battery maintainer on the car. You know, there's nothing more of a disappointment than, all right, it's all done. Let's go around the block. Yeah. And it goes, and nothing happens.
Click, 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 click,
yeah,
click, click.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then the process itself, okay, so now you're getting to the actual, say, Saturday morning. And you've got your tools, you've got your parts, you got everything you need. Minimal distractions. Let's, you know, try and focus on this thing. Clean workspace. In a home garage, I think it's important to think, what happens if you don't finish this? Do you have to temporarily reassemble the car and push it over in the corner? Mm-hmm. And how long is that going to take? And if you only have 3 hours to do this before you got to go to Aunt Edna's house, do you have to set a timer and say, okay, 2:15, I got to break down, you know?
Right.
Right? Just trying to keep peace in the family and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest thing that I came to terms with this past week is I've looked at this old car in a different light. And it may sound a little bit strange, but rather than look at it as an old car, you know, that's broken, I almost started to envision this as being a caretaker of this thing and treat it like an old friend that just needs help. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not trying to piss me off.
Right. It can't help it.
Yeah, it just needs
it's old.
It needs a hand, man. Help me out here. Help me mm-hmm. get back on the road out in the sun where I want to be. And right. when I took that mentality, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I'll help you. You know, let me put another 15 minutes into this, and I think I can get it. You know, and mm-hmm. then we'll all have a better experience. And, you know, that's kind of what it was all about. So
I think that's a good way to think about it. You know, I think about that as I kind of think along those lines. I mean, you know, barring any catastrophic incident, that car is going to be here probably after I'm gone and somebody else is going to be taking care of it, hopefully. And, you know, you can't take any of this stuff with you, and not to be macabre, but none of us are getting out of this thing alive, and all of our stuff is going to be here when we're gone, as long as we take good care of it now, and somebody else will enjoy it for in the next generation, maybe your kids or a friend that's somebody ends up with all your stuff. I got my when my in-laws moved, my father-in-law was a mechanic for a lot of years and a carpenter, and they couldn't take all their stuff with them. So he said, "Mike, just take whatever you want. You know, the rest is going to get pitched." So I got all of his old toolbox, all of his old tools, and a lot of his carpentry stuff. And you know, I still think of it as his stuff, and I'm just taking care of it. I'm just the caretaker for all this cool stuff. I get to use it and do what I need to do with it. And if he ever needs any of the stuff, I'm like, it's your stuff. Come and get it. You know, whenever you need it. I'm just kind of holding it for you whenever you want it again. So that's how I think of that. And it's kind of along those same lines you were just talking about.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, not to sound, new age or anything, but maybe you channel a little bit of his existence through the use of those tools, and maybe it helps the job go better. You know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, some of those tools are really oddball things that I've never seen before, and whenever he'd come by, I'd say, "Hey, Jack, what the heck is this for?" He's like, "Oh, that's for pulling lifters out of a Chrysler engine." I'm like, "You got to be kidding me!" Yeah. He's like, "No, they grab this little plunger on here, and you push it, and these little fingers come out, and they grab the little plunger, they grab the lifter body, and it pulls it right out of the lifter bore." I'm like, "Huh?
Yeah,
who'd have thunk it?"
Yeah, that's cool, and it's so great that you know you can still ask him what that stuff is.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Because there's got to be a story about when he had to buy that thing. He was battling some 318 or something that was, you know, killing him.
Yeah, he used to – I mean, he was a hot rodder his whole life and a gearhead, and that's why he and I get along so well. A lot of the times we're the same person, and my wife sees that too. She's like, "You two are just alike. It's freaky."
Yeah.
And he would tell – I would take him sometimes to a cruise night, and he'd see a flathead and something, and he would – you know, almost hold court talking about, "Oh, we had this. See this valve? We had this. You turn this valve off, and it would keep the car from getting too hot. Or when it would get too hot, you'd open it up, and it would cool off more. And I'd have to have a crowbar because it would slip off the motor mounts a lot of times. You need the crowbar to pop it back on. And, you know, otherwise the clutch wouldn't work." And people are looking at him like, "Holy cow, this guy lived it.
Yeah.
This is great information." And the guy who owned the car is like, "Yep, I got to have a crowbar, and I turn the valve and do all that stuff you just said." And that was his stuff when he was a kid, and just trying to keep his cars going. And it's really neat hearing all these stories from somebody from, you know, quote, back in the day, who can tell you all this stuff and, you know, pass this information along to you to keep this hobby alive.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And again, the credibility of having lived all that.
Right.
I know, so I guess tending to look more at the cars like family members, you know, and not to overly personify them. And this Galaxy came to us. My dad had bought a 62 new back in 62, and he got rid of it and always kicked himself. So in the 90s, I convinced him to get this one. And so the car's been in the family for, you know, almost 25 years, and it ain't going anywhere, like you're saying.
No. Oh, yeah.
And he and I, at the time, I was, you know, early 20s, you know, late teens, early 20s, and of that age where you butt heads with your dad more than you work side by side. So we didn't spend a whole lot of time working on this car together because – I of course was always right and was in reality always wrong, and he would point that stuff out, and he was kind of the same way because he was a mechanic in the Air Force from 55 to 59, and
hoorah, aim high.
Yeah Well, he used to say he flew a truck, and he actually worked on flathead generators that were powering radio relay stations, which is the modern equivalent would be a cell tower, you know, the power supply in a cell tower, you know.
Right.
And he would tell me all kinds of stories, the same thing about rebuilding these flathead generators out in the field without any gaskets. and oh, you know, with half the wrong tools and stuff, and making him run just to make him run. And he was lucky that he never served in, you know, any time of conflict, but they did drills and he had to maintain these things and everything else. So, you know, I remember working on cars and trying to go by the book and everything. And he's like, you know, you don't need that. We used to do that without even, you could reuse that gasket if you really need to or whatever. And I'm looking at him like he's just some old hack, but in reality, you know, he did it, you know, the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. They say, improvise, adapt, overcome. That's what they taught us in the Air Force. So
there you go.
Just bottom line is figure it out.
That's right. That's right. And obviously if you're doing a, you know, you're building a nice car, you don't want to just.
Right. Yeah, you don't want to hack it together.
Right. But somebody who's had the experience and knows, you know, what could happen either way, you know, you can't buy that. So I, try to channel all that stuff through this car. And it's funny because my mission was to make it far more reliable. And it was a 390 four-barrel car originally with a cruise-o-matic transmission, which was just a regular non-overdrive automatic. And of course we had to rip all that stuff out and go high tech and do fuel injection and electronic overdrive and everything. And he's like, what the heck is that, you know? And we'll get into the story of how this car kind of came to be in a different time.
Right.
But it was funny, there was a time period when my parents had this car. Kelly and I got it reliable and drivable, and we delivered it to him in Arizona while we were living in the Midwest. My parents relocated to Arizona. So we gave him his car back to be able to drive around for the winter and go to Dairy Queen and everything else. And he made me write him a cue card, basically. So it's still in the glove box of what this thing is. Because it's
nice.
You know, it wasn't the 390 with the carburetor. So people would say, hey, you know, what do you got under the hood? And be like, oh, hold on a minute.
It's a 5.0.
Yeah, he'd be like, oh, according to this, it's a 5.8351 Ford HOSVO Sportsman Long Block. Whatever the hell that is, you know, I don't know. So
I don't know. My kid did it. I don't know what the hell it is.
I know it just doesn't sound the same, you know, as it used to. But at least it starts every day, you know, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's you're one up on me, my man.
Well, hopefully by the end of today, it'll actually stop, too. So,
yeah.
So my mission today is to finish, real time today, is to...
real time today, folks. You heard it here first.
Darn brakes figured out again, which I think I'm there, and then hopefully flip over to the Buick and pull that modulator out and free it up, and if it shifts, I'm a happy guy.
Cool. Hey, just on the off chance that you do put that overdrive transmission in there on in your RIV, are you going to do anything with the rear gear, or are you going to keep it the same?
Well, funny you should mention that, because this particular platform uses what is known as a GM 9 3/8 rear axle, which means there's nothing available for it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You'd have to change the whole rear axle to something else, right?
Well, yeah, and the RIV shares the platform with the Tornado and the Eldorado, which are both front-wheel drive. So this is a...
Oh, perfect. There's got to be 1,000 of them out there, right?
It gets easier and easier the more bolts you turn. So I have already talked to... You know, I've thought long and hard about what would I do if I changed the rear gear, and the reason why you asked that is because with an overdrive, you don't need a highway gear in the back. And you don't want the...
I mean, you'd probably be lugging down the expressway anyway. You'd probably be running too low of an RPM, I would imagine.
Yeah, you don't want to be idling on the highway. This is a 307 rear gear, so at 65, 70 miles an hour, it'd probably be about 1,600 RPM. Which is
right in the sweet spot.
Well, it's actually kind of similar to what the 6-speed cars do. The fuel injected, model Camaros and stuff got a similar gear, or at least on the highway. And my saving grace is that it is a Buick 455, which makes just tons and tons of torque at low RPM. So it might not care that much. But if I were to change the rear gear, you know, what would I do? And I've got nothing against starting over and doing like a Ford 9-inch style or a Curry or something, but that doesn't really fit the car. So then do I do a 12-bolt it should probably be a GM 12 bolt, you know, to kind of keep some kind of correctness. Sure. I know that a Ford Explorer axle, which is an 8.8, can be had with a 373 gear and disc brakes out of a junkyard for about $300 end to end. And that is, wow, that is a great unknown secret on a lot of those.
Oh boy, that's a great buy.
And it looks like a GM rear end. It's got a cover on the back, unlike the 9-inch, and right, most people would never even know. And an 8.8 can be, you know, built to handle any gear you want at any strength level, just like a 9. So, so I ended up talking to our friends at Curry, and I said, "Have you guys ever done any first or second generation Riviera rear axles?" And they said, "Yeah, we don't advertise it because nobody makes the mounts, the axle mounts for the control arms." So they said, get another one or take the one out of yours and send it to them, and they'll knock the mounts off, and they can build a 12-bolt that would go in.
Oh, wow.
Yes. So that's like plan Z. We can certainly do that in our shop as well.
Right.
But, you know, of course, might as well syndrome again. So now we're doing an overdrive. Now you're doing a rear axle. And, you know, it's too.
Let's box the rear control arm. Just box the frame. Let's do it all.
Yeah. and part of me had thought, well, you know, because everybody has this problem with the first and second generation Rivieras that the rear ends are unique and the parts are not available, I thought, well, maybe this is an opportunity to get the word out there and market some of these things. And how hard could it be to make a run of those mounts that go on the axle and have them all, you know, water jetted or laser cut out or something, mm-hmm, and approach a Curry Engineering and say, "Hey, do you want to, you know, I'll help market these because I know the Riv guys." The downside is it's probably a $3,500 rear end, $3,200, you know, $3,000 somewhere around there.
Wow.
And that crowd just isn't used to spending that kind of money on that kind of an upgrade. You know, the Camaro,
that's a lot.
The racers, the Camaro guys, the autocross guys, you know, they're more used to that.
Right.
So you see how a $4 modulator turns into that thought process in my head.
Oh, Dick, come on, modulator, be the culprit.
Yeah. So I will, We'll definitely report our findings if it ends up being the overdrive swap. And I would approach that step by step and do the transmission with a lockup converter because it's a lockup converter, and then drive it and see how it is. There's a yoke's got to change on the drive shaft and just a couple little things. But
that's cool.
And if it's lugging too much, yeah, then here we go down the road.
Here we go. I wanted to get back to something real quick. I know we're kind of running short on time. Back, you were telling a bunch of tips on, you know, how to make your experience a better one when you're working on your enthusiast car. When you do spill fluids and you getting back to the kitty litter and you absorb it up there, I learned this tip a while ago, and when I'll absorb the major bit of the fluid and I'll sweep it up, and then I'll sprinkle a little more on what's left, and I'll take a 2x4 and kind of like scrub the kitty litter in there, and it will get up all that remaining fluid, and you will probably not have any kind of stain left on your floor.
Excellent.
It really makes a huge difference. I mean, just grind it in there and powder that kitty litter up, and it just sucks up all that remaining fluid that's on
there.
That's
a great idea.
That gets into the concrete, yeah.
So it's just...
So just want to throw that out there.
The action of reducing the granule size makes it pick up more off the cracks and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, good tip.
Yeah, not bad. That's my one good thing I got going for me.
I think my cat actually does that.
Is that right?
I've seen him pounding on something in there in the box.
Outstanding.
All right, so you asked me to go first on the trivia question, right?
I did.
All right, so getting back to my notes. Mm-hmm. The question was, what was the first year for the roller cam in the 5.0 Mustang? And you said 1983, and then you hemmed and hawed and said, but you really meant 85, but you're sticking with 83.
I'm sticking with 83.
You're a man of integrity.
Exactly.
Well, you shouldn't be, because it's 85.
God dang it! Son of a... Ah, dang it.
Some, sometimes.
85.
You gotta go with the gut, but yeah.
Yeah.
And then 86 was the first year for the fuel injection, so they went. It was still carbureted, and then 86 was the next
I got
step,
you.
So.
God dang it all to heck.
And it made a whopping 210 horsepower in 85, but like I said, it felt good.
Well, that was you know, good power for the dark days of performance vehicles.
Yeah, it sure was.
So, all right. My question was, if you were to walk into a Chevrolet showroom in 1967 and build or buy a new Camaro, how many engine choices did you have?
I hate this.
And Kevin said three, and that would be incorrect.
It's 11 or something, right?
Yeah, well, according to my research from 69pace.com, the engine choices were six in actuality. And we had the 230 inline six, the 250 inline six, the 302, the 327, the 350.
The 350 was available, damn.
And the 396.
Yep. Yeah, I'll take it. That wasn't even a brain fart. It was a conscious. I mean, I knew where I was, and I just didn't know it. And I feel bad because I always think that the 350 was later. And the reason why I think that is the 350 SS was later.
Oh,
I see. The 302 I knew because the 302 Z28. Those are
Z28.
624 made, I think.
Something like
in 67, yeah. And then the 396, of course, that came out in 66 in the big cars, 65 in the Corvette, and the Z16 Chevelle.
Chevelle, right, 65.
But I wasn't sure that it was available right out of the box in the Camaro, which apparently it was.
Well, I mean, this is what my research said. If I'm wrong about that, people,
I'm not saying
lay a comment on there and let me know.
I'm not saying I'm right on it, but these were my thought processes because I do get stuff wrong often, and the damn 230 six cylinder straight up didn't know. So,
yeah,
wow,
that's okay. It's all right.
So we both failed on that one. All right.
All right.
This trivia question thing you came up with is fun.
Yeah, fun when you're right.
Yeah. Recently, not so much.
Well, I'll never come up with a music trivia question ever again. I'll tell you that right now. God, man, I was like a fly walking right into a spider web on that one. Oh, a music one? Yeah, let's have it.
Like a gnat to a neon.
Yep, that was awesome. I was watching I did. In fact, I meant to mention that to you today.
And it was
like a gnat to a neon.
That was good stuff. Reference from Muscle Car of the Week with that beautiful Corvette that we just featured, the 59.
I think it was pretty.
Crown Sapphire, real nice. What a color.
Mm-hmm. Interesting color choice, but beautiful car. Beautiful car.
All right, my man. Well, if I'm going to get these cars fixed, I got to get back to work. So
yes, you do.
This was a good time today. Appreciate it. It was fun.
Likewise. I enjoyed it, as always.
All right. And I guess we will see you. I guess we'll throw a reminder out. You can hear this on iTunes and subscribe to it there, and also on the TuneIn Radio site and app, which is pretty cool, or right on v8radio.com, where we also have photos to back up some of this stuff. Can't really do the photos on iTunes and TuneIn Radio, which is kind of a bummer. So,
yeah.
And if you dig this, share it with your friends. And we've got a comment section on the V8 Radio page as well. If it's a good one, we'd love to hear it. If it's more stuff I got wrong.
Or if it's constructive, that's fine, too.
Right. Constructive. I've got to use that.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll see you next time on V8 Radio.